Welcome to Story Smack. Hello, my name is A. Kovacs, and I'm a founding partner at Empty Set Entertainment.
And I'm Scott Sigler, New York Times bestselling novelist, and I want you to die, Mr. Bond.
Okay. And this is episode 7 of Story Smack, the podcast about stories and storytellers in the world of pop culture. Today, we're looking at 5 box office lessons learned for 2016, and we'll also give you the top 10 highest grossing films of last year.
I'm going to bet there's a comic book movie or two in there.
Probably so.
Probably.
But before we begin, just to let listeners know what's coming up on future episodes of Story Smack, we are covering bunches of stuff. Mm-hmm. On Friday, January 27th, we'll celebrate the release of Resident Evil, The Final Chapter, by giving you our take on the first 5 Resident Evil flicks before we head to the theater to see that final installment.
Final. Put final in quotes. Final, yeah.
On February 3rd, we'll break down the 10 highest budget films of 2016. What kind of flicks were they? Mm-hmm. How did they do at the box office? That
good,
kind of thing.
Good.
On February 10th, woohoo, we'll be reviewing John Wick in advance of seeing John Wick 2, which comes out that
weekend. We're going the same day. It's gonna be great.
And then on February 17th, we're covering the 25th anniversary of Wayne's World.
25.
Excellent.
25 freaking years since that came out. That's mind-boggling.
I know,
anybody who saw it in theaters, you're like, wait, what? What?
Yesterday, I was looking at a New Yorker magazine, and it it has an article called Spielberg at 70. Oof. And I was like, is that now? And I read it, and it was, Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out 40 years ago.
So that MF-er made that when he was 30 years old.
Ooh.
Wow. That's friggin' amazing. But today, I saw an article in Variety magazine that had some very good info. It is by Brent Lang. He's the senior film and media editor, and his article is titled 5 Box Office Lessons from 2016, From Franchise Fatigue to Fading Movie Stars. So we're going to go over these. We're going to go over those points right now.
Yes, but here's your weekly generic spoiler alert. I don't know if we'll spoil any of these movies. I don't even know if we've seen all these movies, but this is a place where we're going to talk in spoiler fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to list the top 10 highest grossing movies of 2016. Well,
that'll be good. That'll be good. See who made all that, made all them ducats. All right, Padawan, let's get into this article. Let's cover the top 10 highest grossing. God damn it. Oh, that's right. That comes after the article. Sorry. So we'll pick up. So after we're done with this article, you pick up from that line right there.
Okay.
I got it. So that is correct. That is correct. Let us get into this article. Some very interesting things. We're not movie experts. We're not industry experts. We're getting into the industry a little bit in different ways. But I'm happy to finally see at least one article that lists measuring movies' success and year success by the number of attendees instead of by box office. Because pretty much every year they set a new box office. 2016 was the biggest year in movies ever. It grossed more than ever before. And you're like, yeah, it's called inflation, right?
Well, no, but a lot of those, they might be adjusting for inflation. Like they do that a lot when they look at what really are the biggest grossing movies of all time. And Indiana Jones ends up on that list all the time. They have to be adjusting for market.
They don't. When they say this is the biggest, the highest box office year ever, they're not adjusting for inflation. But this is looking at Tenants was essentially flat last year. 1.32 billion people went to see a movie. And this is interesting. That is a far cry from the 1.57 billion admissions in 2002. So even though this was the highest year ever as far as gross box office, gross domestic box office, it is 0.3 billion less than went 15 years ago.
Yeah. But to me, it's an interesting thing. I don't know if it's an apocryphal story or not, but have you ever heard that idea that the civil engineers in New York City were so, or Boston or something, right before Henry Ford introduced his automated line and created cars, they were so worried about what they were going to do about the horse poop in the street because it was starting to become a biohazard kind of.
Okay.
And there was just so much people moving and so much traffic, they didn't know what they were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But turns out not a problem they needed to solve because of the car. I wonder if a similar thing happens. Like, obviously, if you're in the movie making business, you want people to watch movies.
Correct.
But we've seen it over and over again where licensing and rights and stuff like that is sort of weird because people want to hang on to the census and inventory they have. So I'm not going to let you we're not going to release a movie worldwide everywhere in the world in the same day, but we're going to be really mad about pirates who sit in the theater and film with and a shaky another, handheld yeah, camera yeah, yeah. and then Good make point. DVDs. So I wonder if 15 years later, the reduction of 0.3 billion people, that's a whole lot, but are they watching at home? Are they buying digital DVDs? Are they, you know, are they doing something to make up for some of that market share? And I always wonder if the how long it'll take the industry to react.
Some of it, and we're going to get into a couple points that address exactly what you said. Very prophetic, man. Very mm-hmm. prophetic. But you're right. You know, 15 years ago, there wasn't a Netflix. There wasn't Amazon streaming. There wasn't a Hulu,
right?
Et cetera. There were DVDs. I don't think Blu-ray was out 15 years ago, possibly. But really, if you wanted that theatrical experience, you had to go to a theater. And now you don't. And also, there's so much more competition now. Netflix alone is putting out more stuff in a year than basically you can even watch if you watch an episode of TV every day.
Right.
So there's tons of stuff that people can watch and original content people get into that isn't go see this in the theater.
And now that I think about it, I you know, it certainly Laserdiscs, if not Blu-rays, existed in 2002. Maybe mm-hmm. both did. But Twitch didn't. You know,
correct.
And YouTube
correct.
Didn't, and things
and
like
the internet
that
wasn't nearly yeah. what it is right. now, and right. YouTube didn't. That's right. YouTube's only 11 years old, believe yeah. it or not. So one of the things that came out of this article is Disney is responsible for more than half of the top 10 highest grossing films of 2016, which means Disney is still whooping that ass.
Right. Well, right. And they're well established and understand the market at least a little better than I might have given them credit for, because I grew up in an age when Disney meant animated kids movies. Mm-hmm. And that is clearly not the case, because the top five grossing films are, you know, the ones that yeah. make the list are not, I'm sure, are not all, I mean, some might be animated, but they're not all animated. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. they've diversified and kind of go with their strengths over and over again. Like, they know what makes a Disney animated movie look good, but they also now know what a comic book movie
yeah,
sort
do.
Of should look like. And they're better at it than I would have suspected.
When I was a kid, right, Disney movies was animated movies and Herbie's the Love Bug, which was an interesting...
Herbie.
Well, that's a completely different movie. Then.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm not sure what was going on in the Sigler house when you were a kid, but that is not
I always thought Herbie's the Love Bug was a metaphor. So the first point this author makes is directly addressing what you were saying, that windows are collapsing. And windows are traditionally, you have your theatrical release window, then 90 days later, you get your, I believe it's DVD or network TV. This is the old school. 90 days later, you get a network TV. Then a few weeks after that, months after that, you get the VHS, the DVD release, et cetera. And it keeps on going on the window so they can grab a little bit of money from each of those areas. So the people didn't want to see it in the theater, they're still going to try and find a way to take those dollars out of your pockets. But now the threat of piracy is too real, so it says in the article, and it's increasingly clear that in our on-demand culture, one in which people want to see things where they want, when they want, is making the old experience of hitting the multiplex seem passé. So now, heading into 2017, more people are having discussions about releasing the films the same day in on-demand formats, but at a much higher rate. So instead of paying your $13 to see it in the multiplex, you would be willing to pay $30 to see Rogue One at home.
Yeah, and it's I think if you're smart, you realize that you don't change the marketplace. The marketplace changes you. And those are the businesses that do well. And especially in a movie making world, we've talked about this before on Story Smack, where people really can vote with their wallets. And we're starting to see that. People are like, yeah, no, I know you spent $250 million and I totally want to see that super cool effect that you spent $100,000 on.
Sure.
But I got kids, I got to make dinner, I'm taking a night class, everything else.
Yeah.
And if I can do all the things that I'm obligated to in my personal life, and then at 9 o'clock, once a month, sit down on a Friday night at 9 o'clock and spend $30, but I can stay in my jams and I can make popcorn myself and have my pups around.
And now the typical TV is a completely different experience. I mean, it's a typical TV is 40, 46, even 50 inches. They're high def. You're even if you're able to stream high def stuff over the internet, it's a night and day different experience to what it was 2002. So now you drop that $30. Oh, that seems expensive. Okay, $30, but I got four people in my house. So mm-hmm. that would have been, you know, $49, $50 right there. Plus popcorn costs literally a nickel at home,
right.
You know, and all the pop and everything else in the comfort of your home, and you save the driving time and everything else. I remember when the new Star Wars, the Hope, The Force Awakens was mm-hmm. coming out, and I was mm-hmm. going to sit down and watch all the Star Wars movies mm-hmm. at home mm-hmm. and found out, you know, of course they're not on Netflix, which shocked me, but obviously it's the biggest thing of all time. So I went to watch them all one at a time, and they were $19.95 a piece to stream. And I was all like, oh, you're not going to get my $20, you goddamn sons of bitchin' money grubbing whores.
Right.
And I turned into an old industrialist from circa 1915. And I shook my fists. And now when I stop and think about it, well, you know, if I have a couple of friends over or whatever and we watch that, it's on. I got a surround sound. I got a projector. All this cool stuff. It's actually cheaper than going to the movie. It's cheaper than going to the movie.
Yeah, as long as you don't, you know, it's... Everybody is obligated. The industry is obligated to rethink the way entertainment is consumed, and so is the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference is this. What you're thinking is, I turn on my TV and get entertained all the time, and that shit is free.
Shit is free. Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't get the actual... You could have purchased it, but you chose not to because it didn't feel worth the money.
Correct. I've already seen it 12 times. I'm not paying $20 for it.
But that's so interesting, because at your fingertips, you could have had exactly what you said you wanted.
Yeah.
You wanted to watch all three movies in a row, in your own home, in advance of The Force Awakens.
Yep.
And you wanted to like marathon it right away.
Mm-hmm.
And you could have done all of that with popcorn and your fuzzy slippers mm-hmm. and your dog. And it only would have cost you whatever it was, $60.
Right.
And that didn't, you don't think about it that way. Because if I said, dude, let's do that. And, right. and it happens all the time. You always rent the, or you always buy the MMA fights.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. The UFC fights.
Yes.
And invite a bunch of friends over and whatever. That's just about the same amount of money. That's
like
50 bucks.
$50 a pop.
But
yeah.
It feels totally worth it, right? Because then there's a party and you get to visit with your friends and mm-hmm. you get fully entertained for one night for $50, which was almost exactly what you were going to do with Star Wars. But one felt worth the money and one doesn't.
Yeah, and some of that is I could, if I had had the presence of mind to go on eBay, I could have had all six Star Wars movies for like $5 because the DVDs have flooded the market. But so that is becoming more common now. And even a skinflint, stingy, cheap bastard like me is starting to go, well, that's, you know, overall, that's really not that bad. But here's the thing. We said Disney is responsible for more than half of the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Disney says nay to this. Dave Hollis' studio's distribution chief says, quote, the theatrical experience is the embodiment of our filmmaker's vision and acts as a locomotive to all downstream business.
Mm-hmm.
So the tall hog at the trough is like, no, you are not going to see, you know, Finding Dory 7 at home the day it comes out. You need to go to the theater because we're making this for you.
What was that gentleman's name?
Dave Hollis.
Dave Hollis, sir. Kind sir. Lovely sir who makes great movies. I would like to point your interest in the direction of, I don't know, say, the music industry circa 1990. Oh, Mr. Hollis, after you're done examining the complete freefall of the music industry until it discovered digital releasing
uh-huh.
and figured that Napster stuff out, then I would like to direct you to the publishing industry circa early 2000s,
wow.
where every author wanted, the end result of every author's writing experience was supposed to be looking and holding a book in your hands
mm-hmm.
and creating an environment where you enjoyed the story in its natural habitat and you can smell the pages. And you know what happened? Mr. Hollis, both of those industries rose from the ashes of what you thought was the only way it could be to deliver the artist's vision.
Yeah.
And that is exactly what's going to happen to the music business. I mean, the movie business.
The movie business. He better pay attention because now there's also, you know, Netflix making great stuff, awesome stuff, and increasingly higher budget stuff. No need for a theatrical release. Amazon Originals, no need for a theatrical release. If Xbox Network ever gets going, Hulu, all of these things, they're all making stuff, which is part and parcel of the reason why this banner year for money for the theater is 0.3 billion people less, 300 million people less went to the theater. So what you're saying, what you point out seems to be bearing itself out with the numbers. Here's all these amazing movies that Disney's making. Fewer people are going to the theaters than they were 15 years ago because good stuff's coming at home. And that we could be at the pinnacle of that. And as we've seen with music and with publishing, it starts to teeter, but then when it crashes fast and hard.
Well, and the good thing about it is, you know, humans, I hope at the end of the day, believe in, you know, more happiness is better in the world at large. So they just want to be entertained. They just want to be good people. They just want to, you know, and they'll be there to say, I mean, we've been trying to tell you. We just, I have this little device in my hand, and I'm happy. It's not the same experience as if I watch it on a big screen. Mm-hmm. But if all my friends have seen Rogue One and I haven't, and I can watch it on my 4-inch iPhone screen,
sure.
and then I can participate and live my life with my friends, mm-hmm. yeah, I'm going to do that. I would choose to sit in the first or second row of the theater every time I go to the movies, and I would choose to see every movie in the theater.
Mm-hmm. But who's got that time?
Who's got that kind of time?
Yeah. His point number two, sequelitis may be real, but franchises are still king. He said audiences seem to come down with a nasty case of sequelitis last summer. And this does not speak to the quality of these films, which were roundly rejected by critics, but Independence Day Resurgence, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Out of the Shadows, Neighbors 2, Sorority Rising, all of these sequels did very, very poorly. All told, 3 out of 14 sequels released over the summer failed to match the grosses of their predecessors. It didn't help that many of these films were roundly rejected by critics. And of course, the old wag is like, well, a sequel is only supposed to make 80% of the original, but it's an automatic 80%. But what we've seen with Disney and with superhero movies and Resident Evil and Saw and all of these other ones is the when it's done correctly, the sequel makes more than the original.
Yeah, well, and there's staying power. We were just talking about it. Like, you wanted to watch the first three theatrical released Star Wars movies mm-hmm. before you saw The Force Awakens. So there's legs to that. You feel at home. You feel part of the experience. You know, there's a whole big reason to do that. It's always interesting to me that obviously, there's not one. It's not just that those were sequels, but that certainly may be a part of it. Mm-hmm. But also, the market will bear what the market will bear, and we still go to those movies. We still are like, yes, another whatever.
Right? Yeah, and get so excited.
If it's yes, another Star Wars, there's rationale to say like, dude, they will totally love another Transformers movie. They might be wrong, but.
Well, then there's some point, there's the breakdown. They'll love another Transformers movie, and it doesn't really fucking matter what we put on the screen. At some point, the producers and the filmmakers get disillusioned and are like, no one cares. We'll just throw up some shit. It doesn't matter. And when that happens, that's when the franchise is going. But of the top 10 highest grossing films domestically, 8 are sequels, remakes, or exist in some kind of cinematic universe. So of the 8 top 10 movies we're going to talk about at the end of this, the only exceptions to that were The Secret Life of Pets and Zootopia, 2 animated offerings, again, associated with Disney.
Hmm.
Hmm. So, and this is what I'm most excited about from this guy's article, because this is a trend that I have seen coming that was super excited about when I saw Rogue One in the theater, which that theaters need to do something other than just throw shit up on a screen because it's Transformers 17. He said those sequels or spinoffs that did work, such as The Conjuring 2, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, introduced new characters or plot lines, taking their franchise in innovative directions instead of simply recycling plot points and scenarios from previous chapters. So instead of just giving us the same movie or rebooting or mm-hmm. Remaking, like Rogue One is now, if you're a Star Wars fan, which we are, and most people are, you couldn't possibly introduce someone to the Star Wars franchise without having them go episode 1, 2, 3, Rogue One, 4, 5, and 6.
Right.
Because it's that integral to how everything now connects. And that's mm-hmm. that's why that has been very successful.
Yeah, I think everybody, I do it. I'm assuming I'm like everybody where I'm like, all they have to do to make a great movie is X, Y, Z.
Yeah. It seems so easy.
It seems so easy from sitting in my chair, which is, I notice not a director's chair. I notice I have made 0 movies and, I'm armchair quarterbacking to mix metaphors, but I'm sort of like, I got this. You shouldn't do that. You shouldn't introduce this guy. You should introduce another tiny robot and that'll make everything better. But I obviously don't know what I'm talking about because they don't make movies. And there's probably a lot that goes into it. That said, I do know what I'm talking about as a viewer.
Mm-hmm.
And people are different and people's tastes are different and all that other stuff. So I wonder, I'll be interested to see there's a new Spider-Man coming.
Ugh.
And I think, right. And everyone I know, even people who are crazy for Spider-Man are like, oh Lord.
Oh Lord.
Oh Lord.
I've heard we don't get to see his origin story again. Which yeah. I'm convinced some studio exec is going to come back up. You know what we need? We need to see his origin story. So people connect with his growth, with his path. We're like, we've all seen it. We've all read it. It's, anyways. His point number 3, and we can speak to this a little bit because we've been pitching stuff for TV and for movies and have had meetings with fancy pants people. He says, after years of explosive growth, the Chinese box office finally showed signs of slowing down. Total ticket sales in the country grew by a mere 3%, a steep decline from the 49% jump experienced in 2015.
Holy.
So things, the economy is changing there. Things are slowing down. I have no idea if they have a higher domestic production of films or if it's just they're, you know, they can't afford to go see the American movies or they're jaded. We don't know. But that's a mass. It's still growing, but a massive drop in growth. And at one time it was projected that China would be the biggest film market in the world in 2017 this year. And now people are like, that's probably not going to happen for a couple more years if it's going to happen at all. So, but we know when we've had these meetings, China comes up invariably. It comes up at some point in the discussion. One of the properties we've talked to people about, we're like, well, we have monsters, but they're not ghost ancestor monsters. So this is a very cool thing because like with Ghostbusters, that caused a lot of problems. It just didn't get released in China, which crippled it. Mm-hmm. So they're still, of course, they're paying super close attention to what's going on in China. And here's one point of evidence to that. The U.S. failure of World of Warcraft, the movie, that made $47 million domestically. I think it was a $200 million budget film. I didn't get the budget number, but it's a total giant bomb. Oof. In America. Like a bad, embarrassing, egg on the face bomb. It did $386 million foreign, so 90% of the box office of what became a worldwide blockbuster was outside of the U.S.
Right, and that's another thing I was saying earlier, where at some point... And I don't know when it is. Again, I'm not a movie maker, right? So I don't run this. I'm not part of this business. I'm not keeping my con going, you know. But at some point, you have to stop going on what you instinctively know from your years in the business, which everybody does, mm-hmm. in no matter what their business, and be like, yeah, this trend isn't going away.
Yeah.
You know, and so maybe domestic box office isn't what we should build our marketing on.
Oh, and I don't think anybody is anymore. They're all, if you're making any kind of speculative fiction, science fiction, they are like, how is this going to play in India, in China, all over the world?
Right. Well, I think the creatives are doing that. But I sometimes feel like that isn't the case with the back office, accounting office sort of things. Like they're still like, well, I mean, projected domestic box office is like, okay, don't care. What I care about is localization. Can I make sure the movie poster is right for Taiwan, is right mm-hmm. for India, is right for China, because that's going to get more butts and more seats, and that's going to make everybody happy. I know, but the domestic box office, like, screw the domestic box office, nobody cares.
Yeah, are you out to win an award or become a rich person? Which is it that you want?
Welcome to Hollywood. Welcome. The answer is both.
But China is also investing, not China, the government, and individual Chinese companies are investing heavily in the U.S. studios, Sony in particular. We will post a link in the show notes of this episode to a Washington Post article that is titled China's Influence Over Hollywood Grows. And you can find that at scottziegler.com/podcast/2016lessons, 2016, and the word lessons, no spaces. And then the monkey wrench coming into this, or the X factor, if you will, is the Trump factor. The article says, President-elect Donald Trump has railed against trade with China on the campaign trail. If he enacts tariffs on Chinese goods, it could impact the number of Hollywood films that the country allows to screen in China annually. So China can drop a hammer and say, okay, if we're in a trade war, guess what? The second biggest, almost equal to what you make here selling movie tickets, we're not going to let you show movies over here and watch, because that's how politics works. That's how international trade works, right?
Right. Right. And you can be the biggest dick in the room as long as you're really the biggest dick in the room.
Yes.
And in the you're going to make a movie and you just think we're going to suck it up room,
mm-hmm.
China doesn't mess around at all. As you just mentioned with Ghostbusters and that kind of thing, they have more, the government has more control over what their populace sees.
Yes.
Which means they have a lot more power than we do, because we have, of course, net neutrality and everything. I can go look at almost a million things on the internet. That isn't true mm-hmm. all through China. So we really need them to like us in that regard. So we'll see how that goes.
We'll see how that goes. Hopefully it doesn't impact our business, as we're just on the cusp of getting into this pool. I hope it doesn't turn into a deep end on us. Number four. This was a bit shocking to a lot of people in the world. It'll be shocking to you people listening at home. Star power gets dinged. Used to be there were certain faces you could put on a movie poster and that shit was going to make money. But Tom Hanks, Ben Stiller, Brad Pitt, Warren Beatty, Melissa McCarthy, and Johnny Depp all had giant bombs this year, while movies such as Rogue One and The Jungle Book made bank without any A-list stars at all. So you didn't have, you know, Angelina Jolie's face on the cover, which mm-hmm. over the past decade has been the most successful way to have an international film, is put her face on the cover of the DVD box and you're home free. One by one projects fell, like Allied, Alice Through the Looking Glass, Inferno, Rules Don't Apply, Ghostbusters, and Zoolander 2 collapsed at the box office. Also, a big one everybody was expecting, with two of the biggest young faces, biggest young stars in the world, Jennifer Lawrence and Chris Pratt, Passengers has done very poorly on the domestic front. Yeah. And she was, probably still is, but was kind of the new Angelina Jolie. You put Jennifer Lawrence's face on a DVD box or a CD box, and it's going to sell internationally because they just, she's box office gold.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I want to believe that's because the Passenger story didn't connect.
Yeah.
But, and Jennifer Lawrence, of course, she's an Oscar-winning actress. She's had a lot of very highly acclaimed roles and mm-hmm. her performances several over the last several years. So she's gorgeous, mm-hmm. but she's also really good at her job.
Well, that's what brings, yeah, there's something about her that brings people to movies all over the world.
So part of that is you give her a role that doesn't actually flex all those muscles, and she doesn't do a powerhouse performance mm-hmm. because there isn't a powerhouse performance to be had in arm candy, eye candy kind of roles. I'd love all that to be true, but I'm not so sure that matters. It has to be part of one and part of the other, right? It's not just if you put her face on the box, it will sell anymore. But at the same time, would that be true of movies where she won an Oscar and she was chewing scenery and doing a great job?
I think it's a combo, but it's more of a statistical thing. Her movies over time, like Angelina Jolie's movies over time, I was like, yeah, this image is here. She has fans all over the world. You know, once upon a time, that was Brad Pitt. Once upon a time, that was Arnold Schwarzenegger. So it goes, and everybody has their pinnacle and their decline. But I think with Passengers, what it was just, I was so fucking annoyed with that movie before it ever came out. Like, if I have to see one more goddamn Passengers ad, I'm angry at the movie already, and it's still 2 weeks away. And I remember commenting on that on social media. I'm like, I think they're hurting themselves with this overkill, because it's not, everybody knows the movie is coming, and if you're going to see it, you're going to go see it. And now what you're actually doing is turning people off by just hammering you over the head. I don't know if that was a factor. That's just my general impression.
Yeah, and I didn't meet the way that I guess the way that I consume internet and news and whatever, I didn't.
Well, for me, it was sports, because I watch a lot of football, and it was just nonstop. You're like, back off, dude, relax. It's not just actors, though, ma'am. We also had Steven Spielberg's The BFG and Ang Lee, Billy Flynn's Long Halftime Walk, that bombed.
What happened to Ang Lee?
He doesn't give a shit. I think Ang Lee's like, I like this story. I'm going to make this story and make it my way. I've got all the money I could ever spend, and you can all kiss my ass. I'm going to make the movie I want to make. That's what I think.
Except he's not spending his own money. That's the thing. People keep hiring him. And after The Hulk, almost. Well, wait. Was Life of Pi after Hulk?
Yes.
Okay. So Life of Pi was a solid one, but oh my goodness.
Hey, yeah, but I mean, he's happy to, like, if you want to give me money and budget to make a movie, I'll make the movie I want to make. So he's living the creator's dream life, where he's not going out trying, I need another blockbuster. Whereas Spielberg is synonymous with blockbusters, and the BFG was supposed to be the start of a big new franchise and everything else. And it did not pan out. Lesson number five, and then we're going to get into your list of the top 10 grossing movies. Blockbusters can now arrive at any time of the year. Gone are the days when a major release had to hit theaters between Memorial Day, you know, the Independence Day, you know, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And at the end of July, if you wanted to put up blockbuster grosses. Instead, the likes of Deadpool, Zootopia, and The Jungle Book opened in the dead of winter or spring and were rewarded with some of the year's highest grosses. Warner Brothers bet heavily on this type of dating when it scheduled Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, and Suicide Squad for March and August release windows. And it's parlaying into next year. Ghost in the Shell, Lego Batman Movie, Logan, which I'm really hoping is good, because I need him.
We need it to be good.
I need him to go out in a blaze of glory. He's one of my favorite actors.
So you need it to be good, and you need it to go out.
I want...
I think neither...
Hugh Jackman is from what superficial things we know of what we see him in public and when he's doing pressers and everything else and his work on the screen, he's such a friggin' delightful human being, or a delightfully packaged human being. And he's given, done so much great work with the Wolverine thing that I really want. He'll be his last one. I want him to go out in a blaze of glory. I want him to be Old Man Logan, finish it up, and kind of bookmark this wonderful bit of career he has. But we'll see. But those movies are steering clear of summer in favor of spring because, yeah, it was only 10 years ago. Like, it was summer blockbuster season, and I've actually used that to describe my books. Uh-huh. My endings are what I go for in the ending of Infected and Contagious and Pandemic and Ancestor. I'm really going for that summer blockbuster tentpole finale. And when I would say that to people, they go, oh, okay, you're going completely over the top, high action, high drama. That's what you're going for. And it was a way to communicate how these books finish without giving any spoilers. And now we appear to be going away from that that old standby.
Well, I mean, the blockbuster will still be true, but I also think that humans are fallible and easily forget. And so I wonder how many movies get held for either early or mid-spring Memorial Day weekend-ish, because like right now, this particular time of year is known for terrible, terrible movies. Like, mm-hmm. They made it all the way to the box office. We're going to release it because we'll make some of our money back, but oh, Lord.
We don't want to be up against Logan, for example.
We don't want to be up against Logan. We don't want people to remember this. So they're fatiguing from holiday visits and movies and interaction and socialness and whatever. Let's just give them these, you know? And then there's the movies that come back into the theater because they were Oscar nominated. And we're seeing a little bit of that, too. So I find that the blockbuster part, I think, will stay, but I do find that movies that studios kind of want you to not pay too much attention to tend to come out in January and February. Movies that they think have all the metal potential, they might win Oscars, they might win gold, all that. Mm-hmm. All of that stuff they put out in December, I think, still.
Right. So nobody forgets about it by the end of the time award season comes. Well, ma'am, those are the five box office lessons learned from 2016, according to Mr. Brent Lang, senior film and media editor at Variety. So thank you, Brent Lang. We got good discussion out of your wonderful little article.
And the highest grossing films then, I said I would talk about the highest grossing films of 2016.
What really matters?
Am I going from 10 down?
Yeah, going from 10 up. What really matters, the ducats. When it comes down to what everybody talks about, awards and all these other things, all of that parlays into making money. Because if you win an Oscar, then they get to market you as Oscar winning. If you put a movie out on February 1st when nobody's going to movies, you get to say the number one movie in the country because you're up against no competition.
Exactly,
all of this parlays into money, 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 and
More money.
So let's go. What was number 10 and what was it? That's our neighbor who can't control his dogs whatsoever. So we're just going to let them bark. What was number 10?
Suicide Squad, released by Warner Brothers.
How much did that motherfucker make?
It made $745,600,054.
And like, it's pilloried in the press. It's horrible. Everybody I've talked to is like, it's a horrible movie. It's horrible, horrible. How much did that make again?
$745 million and change.
Yeah. So,
that's gross, not net. So,
but net, I mean, it's okay. That's, and we don't have the information on budget. And of course, it's usually you double the budget for promotion, and they did advertise the shit out of that. Not Passengers level, but they advertised it quite a bit. Yeah. What was number 9, ma'am?
Number 9, which I didn't see Suicide Squad, but I did see number 9 and loved it, which was Deadpool.
Oh, Deadpool only made number 9 on this list?
Uh-huh. It was released by 20th Century Fox, and it made $783,112,979.
Fantastic. Absolutely fantastic film. Yeah. I can't wait for Deadpool 2. I am a little upset, though. There's already... That's one of those things that nobody saw coming, except, well, Ryan Reynolds has been campaigning for that role for 10 years.
And produced the movie to get it done.
And produced the movie. So it's been taking him forever to get that movie done. And the screenwriters, him with the screenwriters and making the most out of the budget they had was an absolutely magical combination. And you're like, oh, I want all these guys to come back together and make another one because they're such a good team. And the screenwriters are already out. So he went from paying out of his own pocket to have the screenwriters on set for Deadpool so they could be there because the studio wasn't going to pay for it, to now those screenwriters are out. And now it's like when a band changes the lead singer, you're like, oh, it's my favorite band, but oh, what's going to happen?
Yeah. Well, and do we know why they're out?
all I read was, you know, creative differences. Mm. Like they, or maybe they wanted too much money. It's difficult to say. But at right. the end of the day, the it was an amazing script. They did a great, great, great job. Even the title treatments in that are just fantastic. But that movie is Ryan Reynolds and his performance. That's what made it. So
yeah, he gets to call the shots.
His dedication, yeah.
So he could probably, you know, there were pieces of Van Halen with Sammy Hagar that were rocking.
Sure, sure. That was still a pretty good band.
I mean, kind of. Okay, number eight, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, released by Warner Brothers, and it made $802,773,227.
J.K. Rowling continues to eat raw carbon and poop out diamonds. That's what she does. I believe that her whole digestive system must burn at a very high temperature and compress things very strongly.
She's a tiny woman because she's compressing.
She's firing out diamonds, pooping diamonds all the time. And they're very valuable diamonds, too.
They are. And you know, I have nothing bad to say. She makes great stories and she manages her franchise with an iron fist, which I appreciate, but has room for me to love Harry Potter my way. I think such a brilliant stroke. Pottermore not only encourages fan fiction, which I'll never write in a million years. I like to read sometimes, but I never write, which is one way for me to become part of that world and part of those can make it my own. Right. But Pottermore also sorts you into a house and gives you a Patronus and things like that. So they're more interactive and yet still somewhat passive and so smart. She controls all of that makes room for everybody to play in her sandbox.
Completely understands her audience. She absolutely understands her audience. So amazing. So envious and respectful of all the stuff that she has done. I didn't see that movie. We missed it. We were trying to go see it, but scheduling problems came up. So I'll have to catch that one. At home, on my awesome projector screen.
Yeah, you do sort of have a movie theater at your house.
I do. Great. Yeah, I love movies. All right, what's next? What's number six?
I will
six?
Say my, my mother goes to a bunch of movies, and her review of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them was the thing that made me want to see it. I also missed it, which was, and that was it. I was like, did you see it? She was like, of course, I said, do you think I should see it? And her answer was, So I think that's a pretty high endorsement.
It's an endorsement.
Okay, number seven, Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice.
Now that another one that lines up alongside of Prometheus. There are people who say Prometheus was this brilliant, genius screenplay. And if you don't understand it, it's because you're stupid. That's real. If you don't like Prometheus, it's because you're dumb. And then there's the majority of people who are like, that's just a terrible movie with tons of plot holes and characters' motivation. It doesn't make any sense at all, et cetera, et cetera. It made a bunch of money. Batman, Superman seems to be the same way. Even guys,
$873 million.
Well, it's the brand, right? That's something that people have been waiting to see for a long time, and they put it out, and people flock to the movies. But almost everyone I've talked to, it's about 80-20. It's Pareto's law of this. 80% of the people are like, it's absolutely horrible. It's so bad. I had my friends that I've been reading comic books with since we were in the third grade who were texting me going, please don't see this movie. Don't reward them with money, which apparently the rest of the world,
some people didn't get
the
that
rest
memo.
Of the world did not get that memo. But then there's other people I've talked to on Twitter and other places who are just, they absolutely adore it. They love it. But there apparently I read about this yesterday, the director's cut of that movie, 4 hours long.
Yeah. Yeah. That is not, movies are a collaborative thing.
Yeah. So if it ever comes out, and from what I've heard, the full 4 hour version, and the same thing with Suicide Squad, it was a lot cut out, like over an hour. Jared Leto said he had enough performances by himself that were cut to make a whole movie. Mm. So maybe someday this could be part of the plan. They made their money, and now when they come out with the 4 hour long Superman versus Batman, it'll sell buku streams.
Yeah, who knows? It may. I mean, historically speaking, that doesn't work. That's very rare. Mm-hmm. Blade Runner's director's cut, world famous as a better version than the original.
But didn't they wait 20 years to put that out, though?
Yeah, well, and over lots of consternation with the movie house and everything else. They didn't want it. And it turns out, he was right. It should have been the director's way.
Right.
That said, movies are collaboration. They are, by definition, not one person's vision. ever.
Well, that begs the question. How, when you know they need to have it run a certain runtime so they get an extra showing on that same screen so they make more money per day for that movie, and you know the executives are going to come back, what is a director thinking when they turn in something that is 3.5 to 4 hours long? They know it's going to get cut. I mean, do you think they just get caught up in it? Or, I mean, how does that even happen?
I think that you have a certain amount of latitude, and depending on your experience level and your ownership stakes in this movie, mm-hmm. you have front-end points or back-end points, and you have more creative control or less creative control and all that stuff. So I think the idea is, I'm not disputing at all that directors are artists, and they have a job to do that's creative for sure, but they just think their poop doesn't stink.
Yeah, well, they think they poop diamonds, and there's only one person who poops diamonds in this world.
I mean, there are people who put out very long movies, mm-hmm. and they are value-adding, you know, and it used to be a 90-minute movie was pushing it.
Was it?
That
was,
oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. All the movies you love from the 1980s,
80 minutes.
Every single one of those clocks in at an hour and a half or less.
Yeah.
Almost all of them.
Okay.
And then now, the early aughts, it was 2 hours was a reasonable, you know, and there's not a lot in a movie format, right? If you're going to make a movie out of War and Peace, that mother is going to be a little longer than 2 hours.
Thank goodness for Netflix and miniseries. And it sounds like Zack Snyder should be making a series on Netflix and
exactly.
have 12 hours
exactly
to tell his
right.
tale.
Exactly right. But any movie, like I can think of, I'm a giant Shakespeare fan. I'm mm-hmm. a huge Kenneth Branagh fan. Mm-hmm. Kenneth Branagh put out a theatrical release of Hamlet, which mm-hmm. was the entire play. Now, historically, the play is super duper long.
Okay.
And he did the entire thing in movie form, which normally gets some of the ancillary parts get abridged out.
Uh-huh.
It was 4 hours and 12 minutes long. It was four VHS tapes when I got it. It's spectacular. It's approaching flawless.
Wow.
I can't imagine, and I adore it. I cannot imagine how I would sit here across from you and say, okay. It's spectacular. It's beautiful. There's a lot of practical effects and real sets. And remember, we're talking about castles and frozen lakes and like it's all, so it's gorgeous.
Okay.
Let's watch it for 4 hours plus.
I'm already literally, I'm twitchy and antsy just thinking about watching a movie in my own home for 4 hours plus. So,
although what didn't bother you one bit was three movies that would take 6.5 hours to show.
Correct.
That didn't bother you at all.
No.
And that's my point, that at some point you have to admit, if you're making a movie, that is a collaborative effort. And you want to tell a story that never fucking ends? Great. Tell your mama. Your mama will listen to anything you do. But if you're going to tell me in less than 2.5 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I got shit to do.
Yes. What was the number five, ma'am?
Wait. I thought we were on number six.
What was number six?
The Secret Life of Pets. It came out, Universal put it out. It's animated, I think.
Yes,
and it
is.
And it made $875 million in change.
It's one
That's
of the...
all I know about The Secret Life.
I know the pets are very cute when you see the previews. And since I'm not taking a kid to the movies, I haven't seen that one. But that was one of the... It's new IP. No major stars, or at least they didn't use major stars in market as far as I know, and it's in the top 10 grossing films. Number...
Of last year. Yeah.
Yes, of the number last year.
Number five is The Jungle Book.
That boom, boom, boom. Like, there's two right in a row.
Yeah, and that is a Disney movie. All the rest, the top five are all Disney movies.
Okay.
That made... Jungle Book made $966,550,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's worldwide gross. So we don't know if Secret Life of Pets and The Jungle Book get the benefit of being a great movie, and they can hire native speaking actors to play those parts in the different markets.
Yeah,
right?
Maybe.
Yeah. Which is one of the strengths of doing an animated movie. Our friend Mallory O'Meara makes animated movies with Dark Dunes Productions. But yeah, you just go hire a native speaking cast of stars in that country, and then it feels at home when it comes out in Mexico or Brazil or wherever.
Exactly. Number four, Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, also from Disney, $982 million.
Oh, it didn't make $1 billion.
Just barely didn't make $1 billion. $982,998,000.
I guess if you put a girl in lead role of a movie, it just won't make enough money.
I don't know. I'd like to find out, though. I'd like to find out in 2017.
That
Let's
thing made
do
almost
lots.
$1 billion.
Let's put lots of lead girls.
And Force Awakens made over a billion. Okay, that was I. fucking loved Rogue One. As a storyteller who works really hard to create universes and having things, and we don't just spend time on continuity. We have a guy we hire as a freelancer to check our continuity in the books that we put out to make
sure
they all.
Thank you, Big John.
To tie all of this stuff together. That's money we're, you know, it's not a lot of money, but it's money we're willing to spend just to get that, because I can't keep track of everything. And to see a movie from the biggest fiction franchise in the history of mankind, to put that kind of detail work into tying different things together, it made me feel respected as a fan.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And I think I might have said this when we talked about Rogue One on Stories Mac. I'm not sure, though. One of the things that thrilled me and broke my heart all at once was about halfway through the movie, it occurred to me that all these characters won't come back. You know?
No, that's not true, though. That's not true. The lead woman, I can't remember her name, but the lead actress, she's going to be in the Han Solo movie.
Yeah, but I mean,
that character's iteration.
Right, like they don't come. The story that I love, right, this came before the first three cinematic releases, which are 4, 5, and 6, A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. And you want this to be like, I don't know, I was enjoying it so much. I was like, oh, finally, like new life into this glorious story and series. And then it occurred to me like, oh, right. So they might diverge from the timeline, but all these characters, because this happens before A New Hope, these characters I love so much don't make it off the Titanic.
Ma'am, your problem is that you like the good characters. For me, Darth Vader and Grand Moff Tarkin, they're coming back in the next film. I could not be happier.
That's true. That's a good point. For me, I'm specifically speaking of Diego Luna.
Oh, yeah.
His character was so great.
He did a great job.
Yeah, his character with his Mexican or Spanish accented English, and just being exactly who he was as a human and still doing his job, I thought was...
It was great.
Yeah, and it's sad that he's on the Titanic.
So that was number 5?
That was number 4.
4, okay, here we go. The last 3, go ahead. What's number 3?
Zootopia.
What?
Yeah,
Zootopia. The hell is Zootopia about?
I think also animated from Disney.
we really know our movies. We know our stories, man. We're like the number 3 grossing movie in 2016. I'm like, what the hell is that about?
Well, number 2 is Finding Dory, which I also haven't seen, also animated.
But I know what it's about.
Yeah.
Because if you've ever watched Ellen at all, Finding Dory comes up. If you're flipping through the channels, you know that Ellen and Finding Dory, and what an awesome, super fun success story that is. But hold on, go back. What did Zootopia make?
It made $1,023,784,195.
That's neat. And then what did Finding Dory make?
$1,027,865,760.
All right. And then finally, ma'am, what is the number one movie of 2016?
First, I'm going to tell you what Zootopia is about.
Oh, okay.
It's from the largest elephant to the smallest shrew, the city of Zootopia is a mammal metropolis where various animals live and thrive. When Judy Hopps becomes the first rabbit to join the police force, she quickly learns how tough it is to enforce the law. Determined to prove herself, Judy jumps at the opportunity to solve a mysterious case. Unfortunately, that means working with Nick Wilde, a wily fox who makes her job even harder. So that's Zootopia.
Okay.
Number one, coming in with $1,153,304,495 worldwide, Captain America Civil War, which was also a movie I liked.
I liked it, but...
I mean, I didn't like it as much as Rogue One.
That plot came apart at the end big time.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, I think that those comic book movies are the best at sort of bringing live action actors into a comic book world. Mm-hmm. I think that was the most understandable, relatable kind of version of that, even though they're spectacular. They have spectacular feats of strength and are spectacularly not actually human kind of thing. I still thought it was pretty good.
They're doing such a good job making these movies comic booky. They're comic book. They look, feel, smell, breathe like the comic books I read as a kid and as a teenager in my 20s, et cetera. And that's, you know, it's been going on for 20 years now, but people finally figured out, like, yeah, don't let Hollywood tell you how to make the movie or the story, because you tell stories a certain way and make them look a certain way, and they make shit tons of money and make people happy. Just do that up on the screen. And now they do that and everything's cool.
Hmm. So it's interesting, if you look at this list, if you are, say, a parent of a 13-year-old and a 7-year-old, I'm guessing you go to the movies all the time. Because there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I'd say 5 of the top 10 are ideal for a 7-year-old.
Okay.
And the other 5 are ideal for a 13 or 14-year-old.
I see.
Which is fantastic.
I see. Well, none of those people went to see Herpes the Love Bug. Not one.
Yeah. You know what?
What?
No one went to see Herpes the Love Bug. Nobody. Because that is not a thing that exists.
I would normally at this point, I'd say, well, it should, but I'm not sure that that is a movie that anybody needs to see exist. Although now I'm already contemplating the screenplay about the plucky herpes virus that joins the police force and has to solve a sex crime.
So that is our show for this week. If you have questions for Scott or for me, or if you have a topic you'd like us to discuss on a future episode of Story Smack, please email us at info@emptyset.com. That's info@emptyset.com. You can find us both online. Scott is at Scott Sigler on Twitter and Instagram, and his Facebook page is facebook.com/ScottSigler. I'm A Real Girl on Twitter and A.Real.Girl on Instagram. And you can find this podcast online at scottsigler.com/StorySmack. We'd love to see your comments there. You can find us on iTunes. Just search for Scott Sigler Audiobooks and subscribe. You'll get a free audiobook episode every Sunday and a big hit of Story Smack every Friday.
And next week, we are talking the Resident Evil franchise, which is a $1 billion franchise, believe it or not. So you still have time to binge watch Mila Jovovich and a whole bunch of zombies and learn about some big name TV shows that have completely ripped off the Resident Evil franchise.
Mm.
We will tell you about that next week.
You guys come back on Sunday if you want the next episode of Pandemic, and we'll talk to you all real soon.